kind, but the region has felt the impacts of fracking here, too. The drop in natural gas prices has led local utilities like NSTAR and New Hampshire Electric Co-op to actually cut what they charge consumers for energy. Also, PSNH plans to lower rates this summer and has taken its coal-fired Bow power plant temporarily offline in favor of purchasing cheaper natural gas. But fracking is not problem-free. Around the country, concerns over environmental fallout keep coming up, including fears that fracking contaminates drinking water, creates air pollution, and possibly causes earthquakes. Because of these worries, Vermont is expected to soon become the first state to ban fracking. And while new federal regulations announced this month are aimed at ensuring the process is clean and safe, some critics say they don't go nearly far enough. Today in the Exchange, the fracas over fracking. Let's hear from you. What questions do you have about this process? How it's done? What its impact might be? Should fracking be given a chance to work, given the benefits of this natural gas production boom? Or do you think there are just too many questions? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests with us this hour. Joining us from San Francisco is Abram Lustgarten, investigative reporter with ProPublica. His coverage of hydraulic fracturing was awarded the George Polk Award for Environmental Reporting. And Abram, thanks for getting up early out there on the West Coast, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
With us in studio, Jim Robb, Senior Vice President for Northeast Utilities, parent company of PSNH, also parent company of NSTAR, Connecticut Light and Power, and two gas distribution companies. And Jim Robb, thank you also for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure, Laura.
Also with us, Peter Thompson, Affiliated Professor of Geology at UNH. And Professor Thompson, good to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Professor Thompson, if I could just start with you, give us your best basic layperson definition of how fracking works, how this manages to get natural gas out of rock. To the uninitiated, it seems kind of amazing.
Well, fracking is a kind of lingo for induced hydraulic fracturing. And basically, the method involves putting water with or without chemicals to improve the flow of fluids from the rock. And the main target that we've been hearing about is the Marcellus Shale. In the type locality for that formation is in central New York, but the formation extends on south into Pennsylvania and Ohio, West Virginia. And until recently, it wasn't feasible to get oil and natural gas out of this unit. Recently, the development of drilling, which allows the drill to go down to the level, it's deep underground, and then move in a horizontal direction into the shale, has allowed this method to be used extensively.
And from what I understand, Professor, fracking has been around for some time, but the process recently has gotten a whole lot better and a whole lot easier.
Fracking has been around for a long time, and in fact, it's used routinely for improving the flow of water from drinking water wells. You don't use chemicals, of course, but using water or air under pressure to hold the fractures open to improve the flow of fluid.
And you mentioned shale, and is that the basic rock that we're talking about here? If a state doesn't have shale, it really doesn't have an opportunity for fracking?
It's more complicated than that because we do have shales in Vermont, not particularly in New Hampshire. We have some rocks here in New Hampshire that used to be shale, but they were cooked up to the point where they no longer contain gas or oil. In a few places, they may contain fossils still, but the shale has turned to slate or schist or gneiss. No gas.
During that normal process that we see in geology as rocks change formation based on the pressures that they're under and the
exactly.
natural conditions exerted upon them. So in terms of New England, Professor Thompson, just to be super clear, except for a couple corners of Vermont, we're not looking at large-scale fracking here in New England.
No, we don't have the Marcellus Shale. The Marcellus Shale is Middle Devonian in age, and we have lower Devonian rocks that used to be shale. We have Ordovician shales, which are still older. And in Vermont, the shales are Ordovician. Still, they've all been cooked to the point where they probably will not yield gas.
So, Jim Robb, even though we don't have major or any fracking operations here, what do you think this boom in fracking and the resulting boom in natural gas production means for us here in this region?
Well, I think it actually requires a fundamental rethink of a lot of the energy policies that have governed New England energy sector. If you think about the situation that we've had historically, New England's been a long, long way away from the massive resources of natural gas and oil that the country has had, which are largely concentrated in the Gulf Coast or out in Western Canada. Also, historically, natural gas prices and oil prices were highly linked. They were substitute fuels for each other, so there wasn't a major economic advantage or disadvantage to burning gas or burning oil. And part of that also was colored by the fact that, you know, historically we haven't always been as concerned about CO2 emissions and greenhouse gas emissions as we are now. So this really kind of flips the world on its head, because now we have this large resource of natural gas, the Marcellus Shale, as Professor Thompson mentioned, which is all of 200 miles away from us.
In New York and Pennsylvania.
In New York and Pennsylvania. And it's like the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. And it's very close to us. As a result of this massive increase in gas production, we've seen gas prices fall to historically low levels. I think we've had kind of day ahead or next month gas you could buy for almost $2 in MCF, whereas, you know, 5 years ago that would have been more like $10 to $12.
What's MCF, Jim?
I'm sorry, 1,000 cubic feet, which is the standard unit for buying natural gas. Natural gas is now about a fifth the price of world-traded oil.
Wow, big difference.
So it's an amazingly attractive fuel, both environmentally, because natural gas emits about half the CO2 that burning oil does. It's about a fifth the cost on an energy basis once you take into account the improved efficiency of burning natural gas. And the challenge for New England is how to reconfigure our energy system to take much better advantage of this proximate and very low-cost energy source that promises to live, as you said, you know, potentially for 100 years or more.
So how to reconfigure our local energy system, meaning, Jim, the pipes that bring energy in, the way we heat our homes. Right now, most of us in New Hampshire use heating oil.
And that's true across New England. The funny thing about New England, if you look at the energy system broadly, we have the cleanest burning electricity system in the country, except for the Pacific Northwest, where all the power is generated predominantly by hydroelectric power, which has no emissions. New England is the second cleanest in terms of CO2 emissions. That's because of the large amount of nuclear we have in our mix, as well as natural gas and hydro assets. But we are probably the dirtiest region in the country when it comes to heating our homes, because we're the last region in the country where fuel oil is used as the predominant fuel. I don't know the numbers for New England as a whole, but in Connecticut, only a third of the homes heat with natural gas and two-thirds heat with oil. As you go further north, I think that percentage goes up. So New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, heavily dependent on either heating oil or propane, which is also a very expensive heating fuel.
All right. And Abram Lustgarten in San Francisco, I haven't forgotten about you. And you have written, as I said, a lot about hydraulic fracturing, awarded an environmental reporting award for that coverage. What are, just briefly, Abram, and then we'll get into detail, some of the concerns that often come up with fracking? Just give us a basic outline there.
Well, first of all, there's substantial threats to water supplies from various directions. The fracking requires a very large supply of water and also produces a very large supply of liquid waste. And on both ends of that chain, there's issues about both where you get that water and what you do with it after you're finished. there had been a history of spills and mishandling on the surface that's led to water contamination. How you treat, if you can treat that water, particularly in the Northeast, is a very big struggle for the industry. And out west, it's typically injected underground for disposal, and that's potentially problematic as well. There's also questions about what happens deep underground. You'll hear from the geologists that it should be safe. Injected chemicals should be safe when they're so far underground that they're bound there. But there's emerging research that says that that may not be the case, that fluids and chemicals and waste can move around deep underground. They can intersect fractures or old wells and come back towards the surface. And there's some threats to drinking water supplies or aquifers from that as well. In addition, there's development, industrial impacts on the surface, very, very large number of truck traffic, for example, and substantial air pollution that comes from the production as well. It's true that gas burns cleaner once it's at the power plant, but there's very considerable greenhouse gas pollution and methane emissions associated with the production and transportation of gas before it gets to the power plant.
Yeah, I'd heard about methane emissions and a big emerging concern. The first concerns of BROM seemed to focus on water quality. Now we're talking more about air quality as well. Mm-hmm. All of you, lots more to follow up on, and we'll start taking your calls after a short break. Our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions about fracking is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. What questions do you have about this process? How it's done, how it works, what its impact might be. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, keep it short, exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 9:19. More on fracking on the exchange on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today: mostly cloudy, few breaks of sunshine with some showers and thunderstorms. Highs today 65 to 70 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, showers coming to an end. Lows from 54 to 59 degrees. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sunshine. Chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. Highs from 67 to 75 degrees. And on Thursday, clouds and sunshine. Highs 75 to 80 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on Medicare and Social Security, inviting Granite Staters to join the conversation. Details at aarp.org/NH. And SolarFest, New England's family-friendly renewable energy sustainability conference and music festival, July 20th through the 22nd in Timoth, Vermont. SolarFest.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're drilling down on fracking and its impact here in New England. This is a technology that has led to a boom in the production of cheap natural gas. We're looking at some of the issues and potential for this energy source. 1-800-892-6477. What questions, comments, concerns do you have about hydraulic fracturing? How it works? What its impact might be on us here in New England? The number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Peter Thompson is with us, affiliated professor of geology at UNH. Jim Robb, senior vice president for Northeast Utility, parent company of several utility companies in New England, including PSNH. And joining us from San Francisco, Abram Lustgarten, investigative reporter with ProPublica, whose work on hydraulic fracturing reporting has won awards. We'd like to hear from you again at 1-800-892-6477. And Abram, just before the break, you were touching on some of the concerns that have come up. And let's take the water quality again. In super layperson terms, Abram, could you describe for us or give us a for instance of how fracking might hurt underground water supplies?
Well, sure. So, you know, the process takes millions of gallons of fluid. It's a mixture of chemicals and water, and it puts it into the ground at very high pressure, and the pressure is designed to fracture the rock, to with brute force crack it open so that fluids can flow underground. So one of the questions is what happens to those fluids once they're underground. As much as 90% of them remain in the ground. They don't come back out. So the large volume of chemicals stays down there. And there have been a number of complaints across the country where gas is drilled. I've spent an enormous amount of time reporting in Texas and in Colorado, Wyoming, places that had dealt with this for years before the drilling came to the East Coast. And in those places, people report anecdotally a change in their water quality that closely follows the fracking event. The suspicion, and it's yet to be proven in most cases scientifically, is that those underground fractures have connected somehow with their drinking water source, the aquifer source. And that can happen by connecting to fault lines or connecting to an old abandoned oil or gas well, or coming up the outside of the actual gas well itself. There's a problem with the construction. This became famous when the movie Gasland came out and you saw taps lighting on fire. That was an example of methane gas seeping up instead of liquid chemicals, but a pathway is a pathway, and it's the same sort of example of migration.
So flammable faucets. You turn on your tap.
Flammable faucets.
And those videos are all over YouTube, right? I mean, you see this all the time. And that's methane coming up through the underground water supply to your tap?
Yeah, not necessarily through the water supply, but in many of those cases, it's methane coming from deep underground, from the same deposits or same areas being developed for natural gas coming up to your tap. You'll hear that methane is natural or can be natural, and that's also true. It can be produced in a number of different ways. But in at least a dozen of the cases that I've looked at from Ohio to Pennsylvania, scientists have concluded that the methane that showed up in people's tap water was a result of drilling.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit more about this before we move on to the other issues and potentials of this. And to you, Jim Robb, this is the number one concern, it seems to me, with fracking. People are really worried that when you put all those chemicals down under the rock, down into the rock, they don't come back out, as Abram said, and that they'll eventually taint the drinking water. What do you think about these concerns?
Well, I don't have any particular expertise in this area. I can tell you what I've heard and what I observe. You know, I think there have been a number of studies that have been done around fracking and its implications, both air emissions as well as water emissions. I think you can find arguments on both sides of the equation as to whether it's a real material risk that we should be very worried about or more incidental. I do think that as we see, one of the things that we've seen, particularly in the Marcellus Shale, is a lot of the smaller gas companies are being bought up and consolidated by the major oil companies. I think that's a good sign because the major oil companies have, you know, deeper pockets, more technology capability, and I think will bring more, I don't want to characterize
expertise.
Existing operations as unprofessional, but will be more professional expertise to bear. And we'll take a lot of these issues, if not off the table, we'll manage them very, very carefully. And I think at the end of the day, from a gas economics perspective, the question is going to be around cost. I don't think there's any issue around the availability or the long-term recoverability of these reserves. The question may be at what cost. If we put more regulation and more controls around fracturing, does that increase the cost structure from $2 a thousand cubic feet to $2.50 or $3 a thousand cubic feet? I think that's the big question that's unknown here.
Yeah, and that's the debate that's been going on in Washington. The administration recently put out rules for Bureau of Land Management lands, so public lands.
Yes.
And I think EPA is looking or working on regulations for the broad industry.
That's correct. And a number of states, as you mentioned, Vermont concluded one way 2 weeks ago, I think 2 weeks ago last week, North Carolina, which has some shale formation. They did a very comprehensive study and concluded that fracking was a perfectly acceptable policy for them. So I think you're going to find arguments all around the issue around the safety, the appropriate regulation of this technology.
Well, and again, Peter Thompson, you're a geology professor, so I'd love your thoughts on just what happens deep below the surface when you conduct fracturing. What happens after that operation is done to the potential for water contamination?
Fluids move slowly in shale, whereas they move more rapidly in the kinds of rock that we typically use for aquifers, such as sandstone and limestone. And in fact, shale has been, we take advantage of that in that shale is often forms a cap rock under which a pool of oil will accumulate. So it's it's a new ball game when you start actually removing the oil and gas from the shale itself. And the fact that you're opening up fractures, you're thereby increasing the rate of flow in the shale. And so the potential for materials to move in unexpected directions increases.
It's interesting what you say. It's a new ballgame for geologists like you looking at this. We haven't done this to this extent before.
Well, it's relatively new. I'm talking here. I'm an old timer, so decades rather than I don't mean just the last few years, although it's been since 2006 or 7 that the Marcellus Shale has been targeted.
Right, that we've seen this boom. I want to bring our listeners into our conversation, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Harlan's calling in from Norwich, Vermont. Hi, Harlan. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us. You're up.
Hi. I'm curious, as you said at the outset, most people in northern New England, including me, heat their houses with oil. What are the economic pros and cons of people up here converting from heating their homes with oil to natural gas? And maybe there's some environmental answers to that question, too.
Okay. When you say environmental issues that you question, too, Harlan, what do you mean?
Well, it was mentioned that there is a transportation problem mm-hmm. on bringing natural gas in. I don't take that too seriously. Maybe I should, because you also have to transport oil in, but they may or may not have some thoughts on environmental. Mainly, I'm interested in the economics of conversion.
Yeah, okay, Harlan, thanks a lot for calling. And I think I'll put that one to you, Jim Robb, first, and add on to it a similar question from Marty in Brentwood, who emails. He says, I noticed that only liquid propane gas is delivered to home tanks. Why can't cheaper natural gas be delivered to homes that way? So both Marty and Harlan kind of asking about, how can we make this conversion to natural gas?
Sure. Great questions. And Harlan, I can't speak to your home in specifically. I can tell you in Connecticut, where we've looked at this very carefully, a typical homeowner would save somewhere between $1,000 to $2,000 a year on their home heating bill if they were burning natural gas as opposed to oil. So it's a it's an extraordinarily attractive heating fuel. Of course, there's a boiler conversion that you would have to make to your home in order to be able to burn natural gas, but you would find that that investment would pay back in relatively short order. And of course, if your boiler fails and you have to replace it anyway, you would definitely prefer to have natural gas than oil.
So there's no pipeline yet bringing this stuff in, though.
Oh, there are plenty of pipelines around New England, and the issue really is getting the local distribution out to people's homes. Certainly, if you have a pipeline, if you have what we call a gas main, which would be a modest pressure pipeline running down a city street, and you could get and you can get access to tap into that, that's much cheaper than if you had to have the local gas company lay a new gas main in front of your house. And one of the quandaries that the gas companies are in is trying to figure out how to get more gas main laid so that when people have the option or the desire to convert, they're proximate to where the gas source is. Now, you asked about the environmental impacts of this. At your level, at the level of your home, natural gas is a much cleaner fuel. The CO2 emissions associated with burning natural gas versus burning oil at the combustion point, as I said, it's about 40% of the CO2 emissions of oil. Because natural gas is a physical connection to your home, you don't have a truck that has to come down the street, which obviously emits emissions. The truck idles while it pumps oil into your tank. And, of course, when someone's pumping oil into your tank, there's the potential for a spill. So from a local consumption level, natural gas is a far superior heating option with much lower environmental risk at the point of combustion.
All right. And Harlan, thanks for that call. Marty, thanks for the email. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Up next is Sharon in Dover. Hi, Sharon. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'm really concerned that all we're talking about is money and low cost, and no one is even talking about the fact that once gas gets in your home, it is highly volatile and very explosive as opposed to oil for hydroelectric. And we had a massive explosion in Massachusetts. I live in New Hampshire, but just over the border, just a few years ago, where a whole neighborhood was taken down. I grew up in a home that had a gas explosion. It is very volatile. I don't care if it's low cost. I do not want it in my home. It is extremely dangerous.
Interesting.
And I don't think that, and we're all we're talking about is fracking, which I also think is very dangerous to the environment. And all we're talking about is money. And we have learned over and over again that just because something is low cost does not mean it's good for the environment or for, you know, people to have it in their homes. And I don't care how low the cost is, I would not ever have gas in my home.
Well, and Sharon, maybe you joined us a little bit late. We did lay out, Abram laid out earlier in the hour, some of the environmental concerns, but let's go to them again. Abram, she not only shares your concern that this is dangerous for the natural environment, but dangerous at the individual home level. Have you looked at that in some of the reporting that you've done?
Well, it's actually, in terms of gas, utility gas supply, it's not something that I've looked at closely. And the reason is that most of what I think we're talking about here, you know, and Jim can correct me where I'm wrong, but most of my experience has been around discussions of at the utility level changing to gas as a generator for electricity as opposed to coal or other resources. So we're really talking about more of an industrial large-scale conversion. And on the transportation side, perhaps the conversion of truck fleets to run on natural gas, which, by the way, would at that output end have significant environmental improvements. I think that the supply of an increased supply of natural gas pipelines directly to homes is something that, from what I've heard, is a smaller slice of the conversation. That happens in people's homes. Your caller is correct. There are risks, of course. It's a volatile, inflammable substance, but I don't think we're looking at a widespread conversion of every home having a gas pipeline piped in. One of the reasons for that we haven't talked about is this is still a limited supply of resources, and I think that that tends to get lost in the conversation. I was on a panel discussion in Pennsylvania a couple weeks ago and was hearing actually from two folks in the fracking and the gas production industry about the extent to which this is a limited resource. The most optimistic projections you hear say that at current usage, the United States has a 100-year supply. The U.S. Geological Survey came out and reduced that estimate by 80% a couple months ago. So we're looking at maybe 20, 25 years, and that's at current level of supply. And if you figure that usage of gas, all these conversions we're talking about, is increased substantially, we're really talking about a decade, maybe two at the absolute most, according to the USGS estimates. And then once again, we're looking for an alternative source of fuel. So I think that the extent of infrastructure conversion here, is debatable. And in some of my conversations with folks at like Duke Energy, major U.S. utilities, and that's one of the reasons they're very hesitant to go out and spend $4 billion on a gas plant, tens of billion dollars across their suite of facilities to convert, because they're not sure how long they'll have the opportunity to buy this resource.
Okay, a couple questions coming out of what you said, Abram, and what Sharon added to our conversation. And Sharon, thanks a lot for joining us. So first, I think, Jim Robb, to her basic point, concerns that gas is volatile, explosive, that, you know, your house could blow up.
Well, I think one of the important things that building out the gas system in New England brings is the opportunity for customer choice to decide which fuel they want to use. Right now, most people in New England have no choice. Their only choice really is to burn fuel oil, which has some benefits, as Sharon points out, but also a lot of negative consequences. What we would like to be able to do as a gas distribution industry is to provide the ability for customers to choose, and some customers may choose not to have gas. I will say that over the last 10 years, and particularly over the last 5 years, there's been a renewed emphasis on gas pipeline safety, gas regulation programs around integrity management, and so forth. Certainly, the major explosion that happened in San Francisco now 2 years ago, all right, has put the gas industry on notice around keeping facilities modernized, pressure checked, and the like. So I think while no energy system is without some risk, I think the gas industry is moving towards a much more highly regulated environment where the integrity issues around the pipeline will be managed very, very carefully.
Professor Thompson, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking in terms of the long-term supply. There are other units in the geology, in the rocks underneath the Northeast. I'm thinking here, again, the same area, a little bit more extensive, New York, Pennsylvania, on down into Kentucky, Tennessee, of a deeper shale called the Utica Shale, which is, people are just now beginning to explore. It's up to 14,000 feet deep, so we're talking very deep.
Wow.
But once these the infrastructure is in place, the potential for tapping into that would be more feasible.
This gets to the question that Abram raised, which is, you know, we hear we have a 100-year supply, but is that really 100 years? Is it more 2025? You're saying there's another thing to consider, this whole other deposit of shale that could be tapped. You know, Abram, I have a broad question for you, and I'm going to ask you it. You may have to finish your answer after a break, but given the concerns, Abram, that you've seen in the work that you've done, the concerns that Sharon raised, overall, do you feel, Abram, that fracking is something the nation should just not do right now? Is it worth it or not?
Well, I try to stay away from that question. It's just not in my realm of wanting to express an opinion on it. You know, I can tell you from all that I've heard, the opinions that I get from the experts I talk to are that there are substantial risks. They need to be considered. There are ways that the production of gas can be vastly improved from how it's been done. You know, we heard Jim mention a little bit ago how the big operators tend to be a little safer than the small ones. In my experience, that's true. There are lots of best practices that can seriously mitigate the environmental risks. You're not going to make them zero. You're not going to directly address the risk of where these chemicals go once they're underground. But you can definitely remove a whole lot of the environmental damage that is very obvious and is happening every day on the surface.
Okay, and we will talk more after a short break and keep taking your calls, so stay with us.
I'm Amanda Loader, NHPR's state impact reporter. Join me as I travel around New Hampshire and find out how folks are handling the economic recovery and the role they think government should play.
How am I going to pay for health insurance for my employees and myself? That's my job. I'm not going to expect anyone else to figure it out for me.
We'll also look at how the real estate market, demographics, and other elements are affecting businesses in every region of the state. Tune in to Morning Edition Tuesdays this summer on NHPR and at nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. Supreme Court wraps up its term, analysis of key decisions announced and others to come. That's next hour on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly cloudy, a few breaks of sunshine with some showers and thunderstorms. Highs today, 65 to 70 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy, showers coming to an end, lows from 54 to 59. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sunshine, chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Highs tomorrow from 67 to 75 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Bruss Construction, transforming New Hampshire's existing buildings into energy-efficient, occupant-friendly environments. Information at brussconstruction.com. And UNH Manchester inviting first-year and transfer students to explore programs beginning this fall at UNH's campus in Manchester. manchester.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're looking at the fracas over fracking. We're looking at all sides of this new and sometimes controversial energy technology, which takes natural gas out of shale rock. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. What do you think? Should fracking be given a chance to work, given its potential as a cleaner, low-cost energy source? Or do you think there are too many questions about it? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our listeners. And Jack's joining us from Conway. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
No problem. Thank you. I just had a question. In our area, I don't believe we have natural gas mains, but a lot of people have propane in their homes. Could natural gas be delivered and used the same way that propane is?
I think I'll turn to you on that, Jim.
Sure. The answer is it can. It typically is not, and I'm not sure I can completely explain why that is. Certainly, propane is much more expensive than natural gas. Propane prices tend to be much more aligned with oil prices than natural gas prices. So you have the same economic incentive. Propane burners tend to be different than natural gas burners. So there's probably some costs that you would have to bear within your home to convert your boiler and your stove and so forth to burn natural gas. But I think it's technically feasible to deliver compressed natural gas to people's homes in the same way we deliver compressed propane. That business just really has not developed in New England in a very big way.
Jack, thanks for the call. And gentlemen, we talked earlier a lot about the concern that fracking taints water quality. We talked a little bit about the potential for air pollution, especially methane being released during the process. Professor Thompson, though, I want to talk about a big concern that's been coming up about fracking, and that's that it might be linked to earthquakes. Now, is this a strong link, a questionable link, first of all? And then I've got another question for you.
Well, it's not the hydrofracking itself that causes earthquakes. Some of the wastewater is injected into deep wells. And here we're talking about a mile and a half down underground. Anytime you inject additional fluid into the subsurface, you decrease the amount of pressure that's keeping potential slip surfaces from moving.
And when rock surfaces move, that causes earthquakes.
This was first detected in the early 1960s around the Denver area. The U.S. Army Rocky Mountain Arsenal was injecting water with chemicals deep underground, and some earthquakes began to happen in the Denver area. They stopped the injection. The earthquakes stopped. This went on for a few years, and finally they realized they had to stop doing that. And then in Youngstown, Ohio, more recently, in 2011, they had a bunch of earthquakes, and they were all near one of these deep disposal wells.
So can we say that there is a link, or do we have to say it's a possible link?
Well, there's a very strong correlation,
yeah.
And whether it's I think it's pretty definitely a link.
Abram, have you covered this?
I have, actually. From my perspective, from what I hear from experts, it's not debated. It clearly, injection, as you were just hearing, causes earthquakes. There's a long history. It goes back 40 years. The Department of Energy has experimental sites in the Nevada desert where they inject to measure the seismic activity that's produced. And it's not just from waste injection. They deal with it here in California with geothermal energy production. There's an area called the Geysers that's just north of San Francisco where there is water injection for geothermal production. And there are consistent problems with small earthquakes caused here. It's one of the things that the local community complains about on a daily basis is whether the dishes are falling off their shelves because of injection process in any given month. So definitely happening. The question is it really a risk? The vast majority of the quakes that have been induced by human activity are very, very small. I think it's the kind of thing that induces a lot of fear in the public, but perhaps isn't as much of a risk as some of the other environmental issues that we're talking about.
Interesting. So what do you think, Jim Robb? Again, this is kind of a scary issue for folks. I read that folks in the Midwest are kind of freaked out by this. They're not used to having earthquakes out there.
Well, I don't have either the forensic or the geologic expertise that Abram and Peter have. I would have to defer to their judgments. My sense is that Abram is probably right. It's probably much more of a headline emotional issue than a substantive one, although the linkage is clearly there. And again, probably, you know, will result in some, you know, restrictions as to where this technology can be used. But again, I'm not the expert on that topic.
Did you want to jump in, Professor?
Deep well injection is controlled by the RCRA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. So it's not as though this is unregulated. But on the other hand, the earthquake, one of the earthquakes in the Youngstown area was a 4.0 on the Richter scale, which is something everybody feels.
Yeah, I could break some dishes with that.
Yeah, getting to that point. Yep.
We have an email from Dave in Keene who lists lots of advantages that he sees with fracking and the resulting large supply of natural gas. I won't list all of them. It's a long email, but here's a few from Dave in Keene. He says, thanks for covering this. I'd like to see a discussion about how natural gas can be produced and distributed with as little harm as possible, as our region, he says, badly needs it. He says more affordable energy will allow people to spend money on other things, stimulating the economy. The oil we use is dirty. Natural gas can be used beyond heating needs, drying clothes, cooking, water heaters, and he says eventually to run cars on. That may be a whole other show there, Dave, but it's a good point. And then Dave says jobs, jobs, and more jobs will be created. He concludes by saying we need to find solutions. This is a win every way one looks at it. Natural gas is so cheap and so plentiful. We in the Northeast have been neglected and exploited for too long. Most of the U.S. has options. We virtually have none. Abram, what do you think about this? Now, I know you're in San Francisco, but you have covered this nationwide. He's expressing a feeling that a lot of people in our little corner of the world have, that we're cut off from a lot of the major supplies of energy, and therefore we have to spend a lot of money on energy to have it trucked in. What do you think about his analysis, Abram?
Well, without a doubt, there's benefits to be taken advantage of from production of natural gas. I've spent most of my life on the East Coast. I don't think that it's necessarily true that the East Coast is cut off from energy supply. I mean, it's the main route into the northern Midwest from our supply from Canada, which is one of the U.S. largest importers of energy, of oil, in particular to the United States. I think that it's a trade-off, and the public needs to educate themselves about what the risks are and make that decision about whether the risks are substantial enough to outweigh the benefits. The benefits are clear, as your writer wrote in. I wouldn't argue with any of those. So when oil or gas is produced out west, it's often, not always, but often in a much more rural area where the impacts are dispersed in places where they don't directly affect people, and the benefits are then transported to places where they do benefit people. And when the energy production happens on the East Coast, particularly in Pennsylvania and New York, it's happening much closer, not only to metropolitan areas, but even in rural areas, to people's homes. This is an industrial scale process that happens in people's backyards. And that just means that it has a far more direct impact that we're seeing and that will evolve over time on people's livelihoods.
Abram, a question for you and maybe Jim, too. You said, there are benefits that Dave, our emailer, outlines. There are risks, which you have outlined. And you said the public needs to decide whether the benefits outweigh the risks. Do you think, Abram, the public has the information that we need to effectively evaluate those risks?
Well, I think we're getting there. I mean, that's a large part of what's motivated me and ProPublica's reporting. I think that the information is spun by people on both sides of this debate. You have very strong environmental voices and you have very strong industry voices spinning their point of view. And what's been lacking is a very candid evaluation of where the state of science is. And that's one thing that I hope that will change as the EPA continues its national study of the impacts of hydraulic fracturing that it has underway. But for example, you hear very conclusively that there's never been a case of water contamination or that the various aspects of the production process are safe. And there just isn't data, there just isn't research to say that. Even the conclusions about the deep geology is largely based on modeling, computer models, not direct water monitoring or testing or any kind of scientific data. But on the other hand, the public's paying more attention to this issue than ever before. I think that's a real success.
What do you think, Jim? Do we have the information right now, the science, to decide whether this is really worth it or not?
I think I agree with Abram, and I think most people would observe that more disclosure, more transparency on behalf of the gas production industry would be very helpful here. And again, I think that's where the major oil companies that are moving into this production method in a big way will help, because they tend to be more transparent, many more stakeholders. I would like to go back to the point that Dave raised, and I think he is absolutely right. This is a complete economic game changer for New England. New England has Historically suffered from very high energy costs because we have been far away from energy markets. We have an extraordinary opportunity here to correct, you know, the cost of one of the major factors in costs in industrial production, which is energy. We can be on parity with the rest of the country instead of at a disadvantage. The job creation potential associated with building out natural gas infrastructure to more homes in New England is phenomenal. We looked in Connecticut at the possibility over 10 years of increasing gas penetration from 35% of homeowners to 50% of homeowners, which isn't that big of a change. That in itself would create 54,000 jobs to build the infrastructure and the service industry to take care of that. The GDP impacts of giving people an extra $1,200 to $2,000 a year to spend on local goods and services and so forth would be an amazing economic stimulus for the economy. And I think the issue here is that our policies are still based on a five-year-old view of the world that we're running out of energy, the next source of energy is more expensive than what we have now, and now we're in a world where the next source of energy is much cheaper. And if you think about this from an environmental impact, if I have a dollar and I want to spend it most wisely to clean up my energy system, I could invest that dollar in natural gas distribution. I could invest it in a wind farm. I could invest it in a solar panel. I could invest it in energy conservation. I know that natural gas beats solar and beats wind in terms of the productivity of that dollar relative
to anyway.
At this point in time, no question about it. And my hunch is it may come very close to beating, you know, basic energy conservation in terms of the CO2 reduction. Not that I'm against energy conservation at all, but this is one of the most productive uses of clean energy dollars we could spend as a region.
Now, here's the question, and you're going there, so I'll follow you.
Okay.
If ultimately, Jim, the goal for society is to get off fossil fuels because all of them, including natural gas, do carry some environmental cost, even though it's less with natural
sure.
gas, as you said, does this natural gas boom give us an excuse to delay the hard work of finding truly clean and truly renewable energy sources?
No, I think actually it becomes an enabler of doing that, because one of the quandaries that we run into right now is that with known, you know, existing technology, clean energy, you know, clean, I'm talking renewable, is more expensive than conventional. And particularly when we were in a world where we had very high power prices, the notion of putting more and more high-cost energy resources into that mix was untenable because energy was fundamentally not becoming unaffordable. Because natural gas has lowered this massive amount of natural gas has lowered the price of natural gas, which is the predominant fuel for power generation in New England, the incremental cost, energy has become more affordable. So we can actually afford now to put more money into research and development and production test facilities and the like that will help drive those renewable resource costs down. So I think the fact that this makes the base amount of energy more affordable, and I think that dynamic is likely to last for quite some time, actually helps mitigate the cost, if you will, of developing these alternative resources.
Abram, it's a fundamental question. What do you think? Does this help us move to that clean green future, or does it put it off?
No, I think that there's a bridge fuel role for gas to play. I also think gas, is inextricably linked with use of renewables because it provides that quick ramp up power supply in periods where there isn't wind or when the sun is down, for example, if you're going to move to renewables. So there's a role, no question. I said before, my research has led me to be skeptical of the amount of time we can count on gas being around. And if it's used judiciously, of course, it would last longer. I don't think this is a question of getting rid of fossil fuels altogether. But I would also just point out, we in the United States hear still a lot about the impracticality of renewables. In the month of March, the entire nation of Spain produced 60% of its electric power generation from wind energy. Wind energy is now 20% of world electricity power supply, largely because of the ramp up that China has pursued. This is is possible, and and it's happening in a lot of other places, and there's a lot of reasons why it's not happening at the same speed in the U.S. But one of the reasons I think is the big push by the hydrocarbon fuel industry to continue to say that it's not possible.
Well, and real quick to you, Abram, again, based on your reporting, do you expect other states to do what Vermont is poised to do and ban hydraulic fracturing altogether statewide?
I'd be surprised to see that. it may happen in a couple other places, but it's not going to happen in the places that are big producers of oil and gas. And by the way, it wasn't mentioned, but fracking is used in oil production as well as gas.
Yes.
90% of all wells across the United States. The states that have a big stake in this aren't going to ban it. It's too big a part of their economy, and their production is too big a part of the nation's energy supply already. Vermont, with all due respect to Vermonters, has less at stake.
All right. Well, Abram, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Abram Lustgarten, investigative reporter with ProPublica, who's done a lot of work on hydraulic fracturing. And Peter Thompson, it was good to meet you. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been fun.
Peter Thompson, affiliated professor of geology at UNH. And Jim Robb, thank you for making the trip.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Laura.
Jim Robb, senior vice president for Northeast Utilities, parent company of PSNH, also NSTAR, Connecticut Light and Power, and two gas distribution companies. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. We have help this week from Todd Bookman. Our interns are Ryan Lassard and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation with Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, who asks why, fundamentally, good people with good intentions allowed our democracy to be co-opted by outside interests. In a new book, Lessig blames campaign finance rules for the lack of trust U.S. citizens have in their government, and he calls for a new constitutional convention to regain control over what he deems our corrupted but redeemable system. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m.